Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Sturgill! Long save the king! The victory fell on us! What he hath lost, noble Macbeth hath won!
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
Look, what I have, show me!
Like a drift of lights of wine,
Macbeth,
I need your love.
That shall be king hereafter.
Stay, you are perfect speakers, tell me more.
I need your love.
What? The devil speak true.
Oh, come, you spirits, attend on mortal thoughts.
Duncan comes here tonight.
Like a rhythm unbroken, like drums in the night.
Huh?
Like sweet soul music, like sunlight. Need your love.
Bring forth men, Shabbat.
Coming home, and you don't know where you've been.
This is a sunny sight.
Like nicotine, I need your love.
Macbeth does murder sleep. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
The water clears us of this deed.
Wake Duncan with thy knocking.
Hello and welcome again to St. Louis Secondary School in Carrickmacross in County Monaghan for the second programme in Macbeth in Monaghan. Now today we're going to deal with the third cycle of the play. As we discussed in the last programme, we can break it down into five cycles. The cycle of the prophecy, of the murder, of the betrayal, of the genocide, and of the revenge. And today we're going to look at the betrayal. Performing today will be students from Patrician High School and the St. Louis Secondary School. As we enter this cycle of the play, the Macbeths have succeeded in their plan to kill the king and take the crown. Macbeth is now king. The prophecy of the witches has been fulfilled. But that's not the end of it, because something is beginning to worry Macbeth. The prophecy, we must remember, promised more than the crown to Macbeth. It made a promise as well to Banquo. Banquo was told that he would be father to a line of kings. In other words, Macbeth gets the crown now, but Banquo inherits the future. A future that has nothing in it for Macbeth. Banquo gets a whole destiny where his offspring become kings. Macbeth isn't happy about this. Why should he have gone through all that to give the future to Banquo? So Macbeth, in his mind, makes a simple decision. Banquo must go, and his son Fleance must go with him. They've got to be killed. This is the first moment in which Macbeth steps away from the prophecy and thinks he can become the master of his own destiny, a destiny that the fates, the witches, the weird sisters, have already outlined for him. So, he will betray his closest friend and, in consequence, will unleash on himself, or within himself, the freedom to kill whoever he wants to with complete impunity. He's going to step from king to tyrant in one easy move. Kill Banquo. Banquo himself, at this point in the play, is also feeling a little uneasy about the prophecy.
Thou hast it now, king, Cawdor, Glamis, all, as the weird women promised, and I fear thy place most foully for it. Yet it was said it should not stand in thy posterity, but that myself should be the root and father of many kings. If there come truth from them, as upon thee, Macbeth, their speeches shine, why by the verities on thee made good, may there not be my oracles as well, and set me up in hope, but hush, no more.
In other words, Banquo is himself becoming fascinated by the truth of the prophecy. He was the one at the beginning who said, this could be the devil, this could be something that we shouldn't get into. Now he's saying quite clearly, their speeches shine, that what they prophesy is good. It happens. Of course, he has no idea that it was Macbeth that murdered Duncan. He simply says, what they said was true. And as I said in the last program, everything that the witches say is true.
Ride you this afternoon.
Aye, my good lord.
Tonight we hold a solemn supper, sir, and I request your presence.
Let your highness command upon me, to thee which my duties are within most indissoluble tie forever knit.
Is it far you ride?
As far, my lord, as will fill up the time, twixt this and supper.
Fail not our feast.
Fail not our feast. Now, Macbeth may come to wish that he hadn't demanded that particular service, because Banquo will be there, but not as either he or Macbeth might have wished him to be.
My lord, I will not.
Hie you to horse, adieu. Till you return at night, ghost fleance with you.
Aye, my good lord, our time does call upon us.
It's interesting. Ghost fleance with you. He's almost lulling Banquo into a false sense of security. You going off for the afternoon? Ah, yeah. Oh, that's okay. Come back tonight. We're going to have a bit of a dinner. Will you come and join us? Yeah, be fine, yeah. Lovely. Now, don't forget, be there, won't you? By the way, is your son going with you? And it's that casual, gentle question to make sure that the two victims are going to be in the same place at the same time. Macbeth is learning to be very clever about the way he goes about his business.
I wish your horses swift and sure of foot, and so I do commend you to their backs. Farewell.
And Banquo has gone off for his last ride, and Macbeth is now going to ensure that Banquo never comes back. So, thank you to Raymond Martin and to Patrick Moynihan from Patrician for reading those parts.
My name's David Lawless. I'm a sixth-year student at Belvedere College. My favourite quote has to be Macbeth's last line in the whole play, I suppose. Yet I will try the last. Before my body I throw my warlike shield. Leon Macduff, and damned be he that first cries hold, enough. I've chosen this line because it's what makes Macbeth a tragic character, because this is his redemption line. In this, the revenge scene with Macduff, all the supernatural prophecies have been stripped away one by one, and Macbeth, he's crumbling under this pressure. It's an almost mythical power, his like warlike abilities, his valour, which has been listed in the first scenes by the captain coming back from the war. And although the three prophecies are magical, and his warlike ability is also magic in a way that he's so powerful with it. And although Macduff slays Macbeth, the moral victory, I believe, is with Macbeth, which is what makes him so likable, I think, because although he goes insane in the middle after the banquet scene, we always have kind of a soft spot, if you will, for Macbeth. And definitely with his last line, it gives him the redemption. It's a very powerful quote for me.
My favourite scene of Macbeth is when Macbeth is telling Lady Macbeth that he has the intention of killing Banquo, and he asks her to applaud the deed when it's done. And I just think that that part in the play is really quite pivotal in the character of Macbeth, because we see a change in him. He's now acting independently of her, and I really like that scene in the play.
My name is Pat McCarthy. I attend St. Colm's Community College in Middleton. My quote is from Banquo of Act 2, Scene 1. So I lose none in seeking to augment it, but still keep my bosom franchised and my allegiance clear. I shall be counselled. In this quote, Banquo reassures Macbeth that should he become king, he will have his support in his reign. However, while his king lives, Banquo professes his allegiance to King Duncan alone. He will not do anything to compromise his loyalty to his king, nor do anything that will compromise his integrity. He will not be bought.
Let me mention at this point the principle of the soliloquy. It's a golden rule in Shakespeare that everything that you think, you say. So if a character has to ponder on an idea or a thought or an image, it comes out as a soliloquy, a speech which is almost like a stream of consciousness. And in this coming soliloquy, Macbeth assesses his position before he goes into addressing the question of how to do the murder. And that's the principle of the soliloquy. Macbeth assesses his position and finds it wanting.
To be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. Our fears in Banquo stick deep, and in his royalty of nature reigns that which would be feared.
Now, in his royalty of nature, in other words, Macbeth is acknowledging that Banquo has royalty of nature. that he's actually very suited to be a king. And within that is something that Macbeth should be afraid of.
He chid the sisters when forced to put the name of king upon me, and bade them speak to him. Then prophet-like, they hailed him father to a line of kings. Upon my head they placed a fruitless crown, and put a barren scepter in my grip, thence to be wrenched with an unlineal hand, no son of mine succeeding. If it be so, for Banquo's issue have I filed my mind. For them, the gracious Duncan, have I murdered. Put rancors in the vessel of my peace, only for them, and mine eternal jewel, given to the common enemy of man, to make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings. Rather than so, come fate into the list, and champion me to the utterance.
And that was Patrick Moyner from Patrician reading Macbeth. And now Dennis Bates of CBS Sexton Street, Limerick, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
I'm going to talk to you, firstly, about the definition of the soliloquy, and secondly, about how to prepare an answer on the soliloquy for exam purposes. A soliloquy, from the Latin solus loqui, meaning to speak alone, is a dramatic device in the Shakespearean play. Shakespeare uses it for two purposes. The first of which is to allow the character to reveal their inner thoughts, what's on the speaker's mind. The second purpose of the soliloquy is to allow the character to engage in a dialogue, typically with himself or maybe with the audience. But in that dialogue, the character is able to work out what they're thinking, what's going through their mind, what their attitude, what their response is to that, what strategy they're going to adopt following whatever the events may have been. In Shakespeare's play Macbeth, the soliloquy is used as a very powerful dramatic device. And Shakespeare uses it for two purposes. The first of those is to allow us to hear what Macbeth is thinking. And the second of those is to allow us to hear Macbeth arguing with himself as he goes through the rights and wrongs of a situation and as he develops his strategy for responding to them. Now, if you're writing an answer, what we have said so far would allow you to write a good introduction. A good introduction would include a statement of the question that you're answering. It would include a definition of the terms that you're going to use, and it would also include an outlining of the parameters or the boundaries of the answer that you're going to write. We'll take a look now at what would go into the body of your answer. We've established already what the soliloquy is. We now want to see how Shakespeare uses the soliloquy in the course of the overall play. To do this, we're going to talk about it in a number of stages, because what Shakespeare does is to start the soliloquies as stage asides. A stage aside, if you like, is a little soliloquy, a small comment, again, spoken by the character, but not heard by anybody else except the audience. And of course, the audience are outside the world of the play, looking in, listening in. In Act 1, Scene 3, when the witches are telling Macbeth the prophecies, Macbeth responds with a series of spontaneous asides. They tell him, for example, that he's Thane of Glamis and Thane of Cawdor. He knows he's Thane of Glamis, but he's astonished to be called Thane of Cawdor. They tell him then that he may be king hereafter. This is shocking for him, and in an aside expresses his astonishment and his immediate reaction, which is that these things are so improbable that if chance would have him king, then chance would make him king, as he says in that scene. The further we go into Act 1, we see the soliloquy now being used for a more important purpose. In Act 1, Scene 5, for example, Macbeth speaks some of the longer soliloquies. In these, he's giving us his considered opinion, his inner thoughts. He has now been bitten by the bug of becoming king, but he knows that it's impossible in every proper sense. He cannot be king because morally he has no right or entitlement to it. His soliloquies become more complex as the scenes evolve through Act 1, and they reveal to us the character of Macbeth as a complex man, very aware of what's going on, who has a finely tuned conscience, but, fatally, a conscience which he is not willing to act on. In his soliloquy starting, "Is this a dagger I see before me?" he ends that soliloquy having talked himself into a stalemate, And when he hears the bell which Lady Macbeth rings, the bell signalling that the bedtime drinks for Duncan's guards are ready, Macbeth's response is, "Hear it not, Duncan, for it is the knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell." In a sense, you could say Macbeth is saved by the bell, or perhaps damned by the bell, but it's the bell which stops his thinking and prompts him to go into action. Later in the play, when we move into Act 4, Macbeth speaks a number of soliloquies, though by this time the soliloquies are shorter and more pointed. Macbeth realises that he has made a major mistake in killing Duncan and that what he has done is wrong and unforgivable. Macbeth also realises that it is inevitable that he must fail. He says to us in Act 4 that he is so far steeped in blood that to go on is as easy as to go back. He says to us again, when news is brought of the forces ranging around his castle at Dunsinane to lay siege, he says that he will still continue, that he will at least die with armour on his back, and so on. Later, he speaks the words, "From this moment the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand." In a sense, he is abandoning his head, his reason, his conscience, of his faculty of conscience, and moving to a life governed by feelings, a life governed by the impetuous heart and furious, impassioned action, the life of the hand. So we see at this point Macbeth moving towards his final end, and in his ever-shortening soliloquies he is telling us how more desperate and how more unreasonable and spontaneous his actions are going to become. A good answer ends with a strong conclusion. So a good technique to use here is to take the opening sentence you had at the beginning of your answer and to rewrite it as a concluding statement. In our discussion, we've looked at the soliloquy by definition, the solus loqui, the speaker speaking alone to himself. We have spoken of the soliloquy as a dramatic device in the play, and we have seen how Shakespeare uses the soliloquy to chart the progress of Macbeth's character and action through the play, starting with short asides, proceeding to long and complex soliloquies, returning to shorter soliloquies as the play moves forward, and ending in brief statements at the conclusion. Thus, throughout the play, we have seen that Shakespeare uses the soliloquy as a very powerful dramatic device to reveal the characters and also the unfolding development of the action.
Now, let's remind ourselves, Macbeth gained power by an act of assassination, a political murder. Not put on by hatred, not put on by revenge, not because he hated Duncan. He just simply committed assassination in order to gain the crown. Now, with that crown very firmly on his head, and everybody very happy that it's there, he begins to corrupt other people. He decides he's not going to kill Banquo. He's going to keep one step removed from that. He uses assassins, and not just any common or garden murderers at that. He uses men who have a grudge against Banquo. He's using men who he can then blame. Well, they did it because they hated Banquo. There are always grudgers and moaners everywhere that you can use. He uses men who he convinces are the victims of Banquo.
"Have you considered of my speeches? Know that it was he in the times past which held you so under fortune, which you thought had been our innocent self. This I made good to you in our last conference, passed in probation with you, how you were born in hand, how crossed the instruments who wrought them, and all things else that might to half a soul and to a notion crazed say, thus did Banquo."
"You made it known to us."
"I did so, and went further, which is now our point of second meeting."
Macbeth is saying, everything you thought that I might have done to make your lives rotten was actually done by Banquo. And anyone but a madman would understand that. Nobody likes being told that if you don't believe me, you're mad. So they believe him.
"Do you find your patience so predominant in your nature that you can let this go? Are you so gospelled to pray for this good man and for his issue, whose heavy hand had bowed you to the grave and beggared yours forever?"
"We are men, my liege."
"Aye, in the catalogue ye go for men, as hounds and greyhounds, mongrels, spaniels, curs, and demi-wolves are clept by the name of dogs. Now if you've a station in the file, not in the worst rank of manhood. Say it, and I will put that business in your bosoms, whose execution takes your enemy off.
Very interesting point here. Macbeth is saying to them, are you men? Are you not just dogs? Are you real men? And it's exactly the same argument that Lady Macbeth used to him when he was afraid to commit the murder. Are you a real man? When you durst do it, then you were a man. And exactly the same argument is used now by Macbeth to convince these two poor, miserable guys that they're real men, and because they're real men, they'll go out and murder Banquo.
I am one, my liege, whom the vile blows and the buffets of the world have so incensed I am reckless what I do to spite the world.
And I another, so weary with disasters, tugged with fortune, that I would set my lie on any chance to mend it or be rid on't.
Both of you know Banquo was your enemy, so is he mine.
There's an interesting step. He's taking these low, common people, he's convinced them that Banquo is their enemy, and now he's saying, and I'm just like you guys, he's your enemy, and he's mine. And he's convincing them that he is one of them, that they're all three mates together.
Within this hour at most, I will advise you where to plant yourselves, acquaint you with the perfect spy of the time, the moment on it, for it must be done tonight, and something from the palace, and with him, to leave no rubs nor botches in the work, flames the sun. He must embrace the fate of that dark hour. Resolve yourselves apart. I come to you anon.
We are resolved, my lord.
Abide within.
And he's saying, we're going to do it quietly. We're going to do it away from the palace. We're going to do it tonight. Oh, and by the way, we're also going to kill his son. And he slips it in at the end, oh so gently, and they say yes.
It is concluded, Banquo. Thy soul's flight, if it find heaven, must find it out tonight.
And thank you to Patrick Moyner, who read Macbeth, and to Micheál McConnell, and to Paul McMahon, who were the murderers.
Hello, I'm Robin Eames, formerly the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Armagh, and I'm going to comment on the theme of conflict and genocide in Shakespeare's play Macbeth. You know, I feel the use of violence, murder by Macbeth, to achieve a political end in the play as it is, raises all sorts of issues for us as people. Not that we all go out to commit murder or to get what we want, but like Macbeth, we often have our own sense of what we can be or what we are capable of achieving if only there weren't things or people in our way. We look at Macbeth and feel comfortable saying that Macbeth was wrong. The choices that Shakespeare presents to us seem so stark and clear. But on a daily basis, I feel, we all face our own Macbeth moments. And I wonder if we are all so good at applying moral judgment as we would like to think we are. Macbeth is clearly inspired by the witch's prophecy, and the first steps towards achieving his ambition fall so easily into his grasp when he becomes Thane of Cawdor. It is but a short step to the killing of Duncan and making the prophecy come true. So with the subsequent murder of Banquo, I feel that Shakespeare puts the assassination of Duncan into its proper context. Murder is murder. Genocide for political ends is an absolute abuse of power and authority. The fact that Banquo's son survives in order to fulfill the truth of the witch's prophecy, that Banquo would become father of a line of kings, that makes it clear that for Shakespeare, Macbeth's murderous progress was never necessary. It is a complete evil that sows the seeds of his own destruction, and it paves the way for the unleashing of genocide or mass slaughter, and ultimately involves the whole nation in bloodshed before Macbeth and the old order is defeated and rule of justice is restored.
Derek Callahan from Delisle College in Waterford. My favourite scene in the play would be the scene where Macduff and his family are murdered by the minions of Macbeth, because it really shows the extreme ends what Macbeth will do to secure his place in Scotland, and nobody is safe under Macbeth's rule, not even young babies and children, like innocent women, are murdered by him in cold blood, and just shows that he's ruthless and will do anything to hold his power. My favourite quote in the play would be from Duncan. There's no art to find the man's construction in the face. He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust. In the quote, he speaks about the original Thane of Cawdor, who betrayed him in the first battle for Scotland. And after Cawdor's execution, he gives the title to Macbeth. And Macbeth then goes and does the exact same thing to him again. And it really shows that Duncan really doesn't learn from his mistakes and that he can't tell who is and isn't against him.
My name is Chloe Farrell and I'm a sixth-year student in Santa Sabina, Sutton. I really like Macbeth as a tragedy. Macbeth is a tragedy, a play of which a protagonist, usually a man of importance and outstanding qualities, falls to disaster through a combination of personal failing and circumstances. Macbeth's personal failing is seen through his vaulting ambition and in his distorted notion of manliness that is so easily exploited by Lady Macbeth. Apart from his personal failings, circumstances outside his control contribute in a significant way to his downfall as well. These are the witches and their unforeseen equivocations, Lady Macbeth's manipulations, and lastly Malcolm being announced as heir to the throne. Macbeth moves from a position of respect and honour to the degradation of a murderer and tyrant. His ultimate punishment is death. Macbeth's fault is a moral one, a failure of the will to control incitement to evil. It is a failure for which he is personally responsible. During the tragic process, Macbeth gains understanding and insight into what he has done, and this is why we retain sympathy for him, despite his tyranny. Macbeth is a man of conscience. We see this best in the struggle between ambition and conscience before the killing of King Duncan. Macbeth is aware of his duty as kinsman, as subject and as a host to the king at his castle. Lady Macbeth's description of him as a man who is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way emphasises his sensitivity. In Macbeth, we see a man who succumbs to the power of temptation. He is a reflection of ourselves, except on a grander scale. There are many examples used in his observations about life and his own predicament, such as, life is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. He sees the isolation he must face in the future, and that which should accompany old age as honour, love, obedience, troops of friends, I must not look to have. Ultimately, Macbeth's recognition of what he has done makes him a figure of tragedy, and that must evoke our sympathy.
So, Macbeth has entrapped the murderers. He's offered revenge to them, and they very gladly take it. More importantly, he's learning the art of manipulation. He's learning the skill of controlling people and getting them to do what he wants. He's giving people an opportunity to release in themselves their own vengeance. But in spite of this skill and this success, he still can't rest easy. There are still things going on in his head that won't go away. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that since the murder of Duncan, he hasn't had a good night's sleep. Even his wife can see a change in him.
How now, my lord? Why do you keep alone? Of sorriest fancies your companion's making, using those thoughts which should indeed have died with them they think on. Things without all remedy should be without regard. What's done is done.
There she is, being the practical wife again. She said, look, it's done. You can't fix it. You can't go back. Everything's happened. Let's just get on with life.
We have scotched the snake, not killed it. She'd close and be herself, whilst our poor malice remains in danger of a former tooth. But let the frame of things disjoint, both the worlds suffer. Ere we will eat our meal in fear and sleep, in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly.
In the affliction of these terrible dreams which shake us nightly. He's saying quite clearly, I can't rest, I can't relax. It's all in my head, all the time. And what we have done is not completely finished. That term, we have scotched the snake, not killed it. She'll close and be herself. That traditional image that if you chop a snake or a worm in half, it'll close up again, which of course is completely untrue. But that idea is in his head. Unless I complete what I have to do, I've got nothing.
Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further.
It's a wonderful image. I killed Duncan, which was the kindest thing I could do to him, because he's got no more worries. I, on the other hand, who am alive, am worried about everything. There's something wrong in that equation. Lady Macbeth keeps trying.
Come on, gentle, my lord. Sleek o'er your rugged locks. Be bright and jovial among your guests tonight.
Oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. Thou know'st that Banquo and his fleance lives.
But in them, nature's copies, not etern.
There's comfort yet. They are assailable. Then be thou jocund. Ere the bat had flown his cloistered flight, ere to black Hecate's summons the shard-born beetle with his drowsy hums had rung night's yawning peal, there shall be done a deed of dreadful note.
What's to be done?
Now, this is the first evidence that Lady Macbeth has that something else is going to happen. He's not discussed it with her. It's not part of their plan. Her plan is now complete. Duncan's dead, Macbeth is king, nothing else. Suddenly, at this moment, she realises there's more going to happen.
Be innocent of the knowledge, dearest Chuck, till thou applaud the deed. Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day, and with thy bloody and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale.
Again, he's calling in the night. He's calling in the darkness, as Lady Macbeth called for the darkness to come and shroud what was going to be done. Yet again, Macbeth is doing the same. Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day. And more importantly, with thy bloody and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale. And that great bond is life and Banquo.
Light thickens, and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse, while night's black agents to their praise do rouse. Thou marvelst at my words, but hold thee still. Things bad begun make strong themselves by ill. So pretty, go with me.
I particularly love that little sequence because it's one that just about anybody can recognise, especially if you live in the country. Light thickens. It's like any evening. Light thickens. You know this point. Just in the twilight, it makes it something rather dank and heavy. And the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. We all know that image. We've all seen it. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse. Light is going. While night's black agents to their praise do rouse, it's the foxes and the badgers coming out. So what he's doing is establishing the mood for the next event. And so, thank you to Laura Fitzsimmons from St. Louis as Lady Macbeth, and again to Patrick Moyner from Patrician as Macbeth.
My name is Billy Ryan from Dallas Isle College, Waterford. I suppose my favourite quote would be, "But screw your courage to the sticking place and we'll not fail." Because I think even independent of the play itself, it kind of sums up that if someone has the conviction and the audacity, I suppose, to set out their stall and chase their ambitions, then they've every chance of succeeding then. I suppose Macduff would be my favourite character in the play and definitely the character I'd have the most respect for, because he's a great patriot and he fights for his country, and when eventually he does succeed, he's able to take a back seat and let people who are more capable take over, people who have more of a right to the throne. I suppose my favourite scene would be when Lady Macbeth convinces Macbeth to murder Duncan. It shows the power of their marriage in that he sets so much store by what Lady Macbeth thinks, and he's so easily manipulated by her.
My name is Claude O'Mahony. I'm a sixth-year student in Loretto College, St. Stephen's Green. I am talking about Lady Macbeth, as she is my favourite character. I find that Lady Macbeth is made to act as a catalyst in Macbeth's evil doings. Even though Macbeth is generally the one to have the final say in many of the killings that take place, Lady Macbeth is really the villain that turns his head whichever way she wants. She really mocks him, and he seems to fret over her questioning his manhood. When you durst do it, then you were a man. And when Macbeth was having doubts, she was, in the most literal sense, ready to go for the kill. Clearly demonstrating another villain characteristic other than self-gain, Lady Macbeth shows the fear of getting caught when she unintentionally gives herself away in her sleep. Throughout the play and leading up to her eventual suicide, Lady Macbeth slowly weakens, although at the beginning of the play she acts as if she was unstoppable. Not only does Lady Macbeth push her husband to do things he doesn't want to do, she does not want her husband or herself to get caught, so she gives him advice on how to look like an innocent player but be serpent under it. Lady Macbeth has already demonstrated that she is two-faced. When Duncan first arrives at the castle, she automatically acts as the welcoming hostess, when in reality she has different plans for Duncan than she lets on. Lady Macbeth seems a bit afraid that she might get caught later in the play. The constant nightmares she has and the fear of guilt become too much. She commits suicide, proving once again that she is a villain because she cannot deal with the repercussions of her actions.
My name is Ashley Callahan. I am a sixth-year student in St. Colman's Community College, Middleton. I've chosen this quote from Macbeth in Act 3, Scene 2. "Be innocent in the knowledge, dearest Chuck, till thou applaud the deed. Come, stealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day, and with thy body and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale. Light thickens, and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. Good things of day become to drop and drowse, while night's black agents to their prey do rouse." I've chosen this quote because it's a significant turning point in the relationship between the Macbeths. It's a reversal of roles because Lady Macbeth is excluded from Macbeth's plans to murder Banquo, whereas in the murder of Duncan, Lady Macbeth is the driving force. We also start to see them drifting apart. Maybe this is because Macbeth is trying to protect Lady Macbeth.
So, Shakespeare has set the scene. We've got light thickening, and the first image we get from the murderers is of the sun finally setting.
"The west yet glimmers with some streaks of day, now spurs the lated traveller apace, to gain the timely inn, and near approaches the subject of our watch. Hark, I hear horses."
"Then, 'tis he, the rest are within a note of expectation, already are in the court."
"Give us a light there, ho."
"A light, a light."
"'Tis he, stand to it."
"It will be rain tonight."
"Let it come down."
"O treachery, fly, good fleems, fly, 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 thou mayst revenge, O slave."
"Who did strike out the light? Was not the way. There's but one down, the sun is fled."
"We've lost best half of our affair."
"Well, let's away and say how much is done."
"We've lost best half of our affair." In other words, they failed. They were sent out to kill Banquo and Fleance, and they only killed Banquo. That's not a problem, because Macbeth's problem is not the problem of Banquo, but the problem of Banquo's line, that his sons and sons and sons of sons will become king. He tried, as I said, to sidestep the prophecy, and he failed, because the prophecy must come true. Fleance cannot die, so he survives this terrible assassination attempt. What has been done here is not an assassination, but the murder of a friend. Not the political killing, as with Duncan, but a cheap and savage murder. And thank you to Micheál McConnell, to Raymond Martin, and to Paul McMahon, all from Patrician, for reading The Murderers and Banquo. And now Sonia Sexton of St. Louis, Carrickmacross, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
I'm going to look at an approach to the following question. Macbeth is a man of noble disposition, dragged down by his connection with his wife's coarser nature. Discuss. When approaching a question such as this, it is generally a good idea to decide whether you agree or disagree with the statement and to do so in your opening paragraph. For this question, I would suggest you could argue that indeed Macbeth does seem to have a noble disposition at the beginning of the play, and there is substantial evidence that the coarser nature of his wife does influence the uxorious Macbeth in his initial bloody deeds, but ultimately Macbeth is responsible for his own downfall. This opening statement, which refers precisely to the question posed, will form the basis for your answer. After your opening paragraph, you should discuss noble disposition as it relates to the character of Macbeth. Macbeth's credentials are clearly established at the beginning of the play through the testimony of others. For example, "Brave Macbeth, well he deserves that name," spoken by a sergeant in Duncan's army. Macbeth's noble disposition is further asserted when Duncan rewards his loyalty and bravery in battle by giving him the title Thane of Cawdor. Interestingly, he is rewarded for his bloody execution on the battlefield. We are spared no detail when it is recounted how he unseamed MacDonald from the nave to the chaps and fixed his head upon our battlements. It is clear his nobility largely lies in his bravery for and loyalty to Duncan and Scotland, and as a warrior on their behalf. Further evidence of a possible noble nature, however, is found in Macbeth's awareness of his bond to Duncan and Scotland and his position of double trust. This awareness of his obligation to protect Duncan, not murder him, is perhaps a sign of an initial noble nature. Similarly, his guilt, however brief, after the murder of Duncan, points to a noble disposition. Now, having established Macbeth's noble disposition, you should develop your answer by focusing on Lady Macbeth and the bountiful evidence of her coarser nature. Principally, you will be examining her language in Act 1, Scene 5. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. In this scene, we see Lady Macbeth's control and single-mindedness as she rejects her natural femininity and asks for the cloak of blackest hell to mask her evil intent and actions. We further see her coarser nature in Act 1, Scene 7, when she uses graphic imagery and emotional blackmail to bring Macbeth from, we will proceed no further in this business, to, if we should fail. Her brutal negation of her maternal instinct in the lines, "I have given suck," is shocking, and her coarseness is not lost on Macbeth, as he states, "Bring forth men children only, for thy undaunted metal should compose nothing but male." Crucially, Lady Macbeth succeeds in quelling Macbeth's misgivings, and they proceed with their plans to murder Duncan. When you have discussed Lady Macbeth's coarser nature and established her influence in relation to Duncan's murder, you need to draw a line under the influence she brings to bear on Macbeth's behaviour after the murder of Duncan. There is a limit to her influence. Macbeth moves on to even more heinous crimes as Lady Macbeth effectively disappears and Macbeth himself takes centre stage. Her last sane act is desperately trying to calm the guests in the banquet scene. At this point in your answer, you need to show that Macbeth is responsible for his own downfall. Now might be a good time to briefly consider the role of the witches. It is important to remember, however, that within the boundaries of this specific question posed, it would be wrong to dwell too long on the witches. For the purposes of this question, you must show that their influence is limited. Remember, the witches appear to both Banquo and Macbeth, yet Banquo, while tempted, does not act. The witches even admit in Act 3, Scene 5, that what they are doing is an illusion. Their business is not destiny, but trickery. Macbeth refuses to accept this, and significantly is further drawn to them the more desperate he becomes and actively seeks them out in Act 4, Scene 1. This very deliberate act of meeting the witches and his unwavering trust in their subsequent apparitions is an integral part of Macbeth's autonomous fall from grace. This he did by himself without consulting with his wife. At this point in the argument, you can outline other significant episodes where we see Macbeth's independent capacity for evil. Consider the murder of Banquo and attempted murder of Fleance. Lady Macbeth is not privy to Macbeth's plans at this point. He tells her to be innocent of the knowledge. The attack on Macduff's castle and the murders within are also highly significant when establishing Macbeth's responsibility for his own downfall. The following key quotations are important at this juncture. "I am stepped in blood so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er." These words are spoken by Macbeth in Act 3 in Scene 4 and indicate his state of mind, where he feels that he has passed the point of no return in terms of bloody murder and it is easier to keep going than to turn back. Another important quote in relation to Macbeth's independent tyranny is, "From this moment the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand." These words clearly articulate Macbeth's intention to act without reflection, consultation, or recourse to moral judgment. And so, to conclude your answer, you should reiterate the terms of the question. Yes, Macbeth was a man of noble disposition. There is no doubt that the coarser, persuasive nature of his wife influenced him strongly to murder Duncan, and indeed the witches had some influence also. However, at a certain point, Macbeth made his own independent descent into darkness and dragged himself down. Macbeth is ultimately responsible for his own downfall and probably realises it himself. It could be argued that Macbeth regrets, but one thing is for certain, if so, he regrets too late. Nothing can change the fact that by the end of the play, noble Macbeth has been well and truly replaced by a hellhound, a dead butcher, a tyrant.
So to recap, Banquo had done nothing wrong, posed no threat. Banquo is murdered. Murdered to protect Macbeth's position, but more important, to prevent Banquo's line becoming king's. The prophecy told Macbeth he would be king, told Macbeth he would be the head of a line of kings. The prophecy must be true. So Fleance survives. Just, let us remember, as Malcolm, Duncan's son, also survived. Macbeth instructed Banquo not to fail the feast, and Banquo keeps his word. With all the other guests assembled, Macbeth complains of the fact that Banquo is absent, and Banquo appears.
Here had we now our country's honour roofed, with the graced person of a Banquo present, who may I rather challenge for unkindness than pity for mischance.
His absence, sir, lays blame upon his promise. Please, your highness, to grace us with your royal company.
The table's full.
Here is a place reserved, sir.
Where?
Here, my good lord. What is it that moves your highness?
Which of you have done this?
What, my good lord?
Thou canst not say I did it. Never shake thy gory locks at me.
Gentlemen, rise. His highness is not well.
Sit, worthy friends. My lord is often thus, and hath been from his youth. Pray you, keep seat. The fit is momentary. Upon a thought, he will again be well. If much you note him, you shall offend him and extend his passion. Feed and regard him not.
Lady Macbeth knows that something's seriously wrong, because Macbeth seems to be losing it. There's nothing in the room, nothing for him to see, nobody else can see anything, but he's going crazy.
Are you a man?
Aye, and a bold one, that dare look on that which might appall the devil.
Oh, proper stuff. This is the very painting of your fear. This is the air-drawn dagger which you said led you to Duncan. Shame itself. Why do you make such faces? When all's done, you look but on a stool.
She knows what's happening. She knows there's something clicking in his brain. He told her about that famous dagger that he saw before him with the gouts of blood on it. She knows this is just pressure working on him. So she tries to explain to him, you're just imagining it.
Pretty, see there. Behold, look, lo, how say you? Why, what care I? If thou canst nod, speak to. If charnel houses and our graves must send, those that we bury back, our monuments shall be the maws of kites.
Banquo's ghost, whether it's real or imaginary, is tipping Macbeth over the edge. He's actually beginning to lose control.
If I stand here, I saw him.
Fie for shame.
Blood had been shed ere now, in the olden time. Ere human statue pours the gentle wheel, aye, and since too murders have been performed, too terrible for the ear. The times have been that when the brains were out, the man would die, and there an end. But now they rise again, with 20 mortal murders on their crowns, and push us from our stools. This is more strange than such a murder is.
His guilt at seeing the ghost is the first crack in his armour. He sees the ghost and the guilt starts to flow out of him. And he's going to actually say it all in front of these people unless she can shut him up. And he makes statements that are so extreme. The times have been that when the brains were out, the man would die. I mean, it's a glorious image. When you kill somebody, they're dead. So what are they doing coming back? All of these confusions, all coming with this great well of guilt, again proving to a degree that this is not a monster. This is just a man who's done something monstrous. An ordinary man like you and me.
It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood. Stones have been known to move and trees to speak. Augurs and understood relations have by maggot pies and choughs and rooks brought forth the secretest man of blood. What is the night?
Almost at odds with morning. Which is which?
How sayest thou that Macduff denies his person at our great bidding?
Did you send to him, sir?
I hear it by the way, but I will send. There's not a one of them, but in his house I keep a servant feed.
It's an interesting little side point as well, that already in the households of all the nobles, all the thanes, Macbeth has got a paid spy.
I will tomorrow, and betimes I will, to the weird sisters. More shall they speak, for now I am bent to know. By the worst means the worst.
By the worst means the worst. I will go and summon up demons to find out the truth. He now knows that no matter what he does, his destiny is set, that he can't change it. So now he realizes he needs to know more.
For mine own good, all causes shall give way. I am in blood, stepped in so far that, should I wade no more, returning where as tedious as gore. Strange things I have in head that will to hand, which must be acted ere they may be scanned.
You lack the season of all natures, sleep.
Come, we'll to sleep. My strains and self-abuse is the initiate fear that wants hard use. We are yet but young indeed.
This is where the next major change takes place in Macbeth. First, the realization that the dead don't stay dead. The ghosts of those we kill will always be with us, seeking revenge, and that there's now no turning back. He begins to realize that the only way of understanding what has happened must be to go back to the source of the prophecy. He must find out the truth by the worst means, by trafficking with evil. And then that most awful confession. I am in blood, stepped in so far, that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as Gawor. He's reached the point where there is no longer a road back. The prophecy has driven him to commit himself to this terrible course of action. He has lost his way in the blood of his victims. And in order to survive, he now knows he's got to wade a lot deeper in blood. So thank you to Rona Lennon as Ross, Patrick Moyner as Macbeth, Daryl Caplice as Lennox, and Mary-Kate Markey as Lady Macbeth. And in today's quiz, representing St. Louis, we have...
Catherine Ward.
From Patrician...
Daryl Caplice.
From Collegiate...
Amy Boyd.
And from St. McCartan's...
Brian Boyd.
So, we begin with a question to each of you. Catherine, your question. Who says... I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition which all leaps itself and falls on the other.
Macbeth.
Correct. Daryl, who says Macbeth doth murder sleep, the innocent sleep that knits up the raffled sleeve of care?
Macbeth.
Correct. Amy, who says a little water clears us of this deed?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. And now Brian, who says, and prophesying with accents terrible of dire combustion and confused events new hatched to the woeful time, the obscure bird clamoured the livelong night.
Ross?
Wrong. Sorry, it's Lennox. So, round two. Now, in this one, you're each going to be played part of a recording from the play, and I'm going to ask you a question about it. Catherine, here's yours.
Do you not hope your children shall be kings, when those that gave the Thane of Cawdor to me promised no less to them?
That trust at home might yet enkindle you unto the crown besides the Thane of Cawdor. What is strange? And oftentimes to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest consequence.
Now, who's speaking to whom?
Macbeth Banquo.
Correct. That's 2 points. And Daryl, here's yours.
Was it so late, friend, ere you went to bed, that you do lie so late?
Late, sir. We were carousing till the second cock, and drink, sir, is a great provoker of 3 things.
Huh? What 3 things does drink especially provoke?
So, who's speaking to whom?
Macduff to the porter.
Correct. Well done. 2 points. Amy, here's yours.
What is a traitor?
Why, one that swears and lies.
And be all traitors that do so?
Everyone that does so is a traitor and must be hanged.
And must they all be hanged that swear and lie?
Everyone.
Who must hang them?
Why, the honest men.
Then the liars and swearers are fools. For there are liars and swearers enow to beat the honest men and hang up them.
So, Amy, who's speaking to who?
Lady Macduff and her son.
That's correct. 2 points. And the last one is for you, Brian.
What is thy name?
Thou'll be afraid to hear it.
No, though thou call'st thyself a hotter name than any is in hell.
My name is Macbeth.
The devil himself could not pronounce a title more hateful to mine ear.
No, nor more fearful.
Thou liest, abhorred tyrant. With my sword, I'll prove the lie thou speakst!
So, Brian, who's speaking to who?
Macbeth to young Sire.
That's correct. Well done. So that's 2 points each again. And now, these are the quickfire questions, so let's have your fingers on your buzzers, and off we go. How will Lady Macbeth summon Macbeth to commit the murder?
Striking a bell.
That was Catherine from St. Louis. That's correct. Lady Macbeth says, I've drugged their possets. What is a posset? Yes, Catherine.
It's a type of drink.
A type of drink, yes. To be actually accurate, it's a sweet spiced milk curdled with wine or ale. Sounds revolting. Who is Hecate? And that was Daryl.
The Queen of the Witches.
That's correct. With what implements will Macbeth commit the murder? That's Catherine again.
Two daggers.
Correct, two daggers. To whom do the daggers belong? Yes, that's Amy.
The grooms.
To the grooms or the chamberlains, yes, correct. Who discovers Duncan's body? That's Daryl.
Macduff.
That's correct. Why does Lady Macbeth return the daggers to the grooms? That was Catherine.
To make it appear that the grooms murdered Duncan.
Where does Malcolm go after the murder? Catherine again.
To England.
To England, yes. Where does Donald Bane go? That was Amy.
To Ireland.
To Ireland. Much more sensible choice. Where will Duncan be buried? That's Brian.
In Columbkill.
Columbkill is correct. Who does Macduff suspect are behind the king's murder? And Daryl.
Duncan's sons.
That's correct. Why is Banquo suspicious of Macbeth? Daryl again.
Because of the witch's prophecies to Macbeth.
That's correct. Why are Malcolm and Donald Bane suspected of their father's murder? Catherine.
Because they fled.
Because they fled. Stolen away and fled. Who does Macbeth ask the three murderers to kill? That was Amy.
Banquo and his son.
Correct. And there we are. And at the end of today's quiz, St. McCartan's, 3. Collegiate have 7. Patrician have 8. And St. Louis have 10. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. And I'm Alan Stanford of Second Age Theatre Company. Join us next week when we examine the genocide in Macbeth.
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love. Like a drift in lands of wind, hot moon, I need your love. I need your love.